Well, good morning. I think I know all of you. My name is Ryan Gross. Just keep going. Okay, Doug is going to turn me higher, I think. How's that? Good? No? A little more? A little more? Keep a little louder? A little more? Keep going? Oh, now I can hear myself. Okay. Good. My name is Ryan Gross. I'm one of the elders here at Faith Presbyterian. If I haven't met you, I think I know all of you. But the pastors were looking for volunteers to teach Sunday school recently. And as many of you know, I have recently retired from the practice of medicine. And so my only current weekly appointment is to take out the garbage on Tuesday morning. And I didn't really have a good excuse not to volunteer for this, so you are now afflicted with me because I volunteered. Let's open with a word of prayer together this morning, and then we'll get started. Heavenly Father, we thank you for another Lord's Day, for the freedom and joy and privilege to gather in your house with your people, to be together in worship of the living and the true God, the God who created all things, made all things, the smallest to the greatest. And we pray that you will be with us in this Lord's Day in our worship, that it will be in spirit and in truth, and then also in this hour together, that we might think about some of the great creative powers of the Lord our God and the things that he has made and that we can be in awe of. And so in this study together, we pray that you will create in us new thoughts and new ways of worshiping you and giving you the honor and the glory for all of it to enjoy you forever. And we pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. So I thought, given my recent retirement, that I would just, it's a time of reflection for me a little bit, and I look back and think about how the world has changed in the 40 years since I started medical school, the 45 years or so since I started college, and it's a convenient time to use as a hook to think about some things that have changed in the world of biology, in the world of medicine over time. And so we're going to use that as a hook. And primarily, as you see in the bulletin, my title is God is Sovereign, Darwin Was Mistaken, and Helen Clapesaddle Altered the Course of My Life. And these are a few theological reflections from my time as a physician and as a biologist. I'm not sure if I will get to Helen Clapesaddle this week, so if you want to know about how Helen Clapesaddle altered my life, we may have to come back next week. I'm not sure. There are two goals to this discussion and for this class, and we want to be consistent with the Westminster Confession of Faith that says man has two chief ends. The first is to glorify God, who is the creator of all things. He is the creator of life. And we want to acknowledge that he is sovereign over all things. We want to learn a little bit about his invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature, as it is displayed in his creation. And we want to enjoy God forever. Part of enjoying God entails thinking in detail about his creation, and particularly human beings, other living creatures, how they work, how they're made, how they grow, how they change. Most of us, I think, if you ponder it, will realize, already realize, that if you really enjoy something, a hobby, watching sports. I guess today is the Super Bowl, so people will be watching football. My wife loves to watch football, not because she cares about the teams or the individual players, but she loves to watch the athleticism. It's kind of like ballet with violence in a way, right? But she loves to watch somebody catch a football and tiptoe 2 feet inbounds and have it just be on the razor's edge of being a legal catch, and that's fascinating. So she is awestruck by that athletic performance. Maybe it's music. Maybe it's someone who sings well, plays a piano well, plays a cello well, directs a choir, directs an orchestra, what have you. Whatever it is, if we are going to enjoy it, we're going to be somewhat awestruck by it. If we are going to enjoy God, we are going to be awestruck by him. He does all things well, of course. And we want to be able to give him the glory, and we want to be able to do so knowledgeably, and we want to be able to do so thoroughly. And so in our technological age, living as we do now in the 21st century, we can see further out and further in than any people who have ever lived in God's creation. We have our five senses, as everyone always has. You can look up at the stars. You can look down at small animals, bugs, and little creatures. But now with technology, we can see even further. We can see even deeper. And all of science, ultimately, you can define science all sorts of ways, but all of science, in a way, is just a way of looking more and more deeply and understanding better and better, looking out, looking in, and seeing further than people did before. And that's our one advantage. We don't have a lot of advantages over our predecessors, but this is one advantage that we have. Seeing further out and seeing further in. So our awe of God, our enjoyment of God, our knowing his creation ought to be at the highest point in recorded history. We can see his excellences as never before. When I was 7 or 8 years old, I was fascinated by little creatures. Some of them were mosquitoes. Do you know that mosquitoes lay eggs on still water, on pond scum, and a mosquito will lay a raft of eggs. You can identify a little raft of mosquito eggs. And if you're a little 7 or 8 year old nerd in Indiana, you'll take the mosquito eggs home in a jar, and they will hatch. And the little mosquito larvae will go down into the water and do the things that mosquito larvae will do. And they will molt, and they will make bigger mosquito larvae, and they will be bigger and bigger and bigger, until eventually one day, the mosquito pupates, and a mosquito turns into a little pupa, and it floats, and it has a little straw that sticks up, and it breathes out of the water, and then, after a few days, the mosquito hatches up out of the pupa, and climbs up out onto the layer of the water, expands its wings, flies away, and comes and looks for you to bite you. The other thing my little nerd heart liked, back before monarch butterflies were an endangered species, we had an abundance of milkweed in our yard in Indiana, and I could go and find monarch butterfly eggs. Monarch butterflies lay a single egg. It looks like a crown. It's a little white or yellow crown, and they lay it on the underside of a milkweed leaf. And I could go out, you have to look under each leaf. You'd see the monarch butterflies flying around. You'd go out and find the eggs, and I would collect the eggs. And we had little Tupperware containers or whatever, and I would feed, the caterpillar would hatch, and I would feed the caterpillar milkweed leaves, because that's all they eat, and it would grow, and it would grow, and it would grow, and it would gradually get to a certain size, and then it would go up and spin a little web, and it hook its little caterpillar feet onto the top of the Tupperware container, or onto a stick if you put it in there. It would hang upside down, and it would molt the last time. And when it shed its skin, this little caterpillar skin would fall off, and there would be this beautiful green jewel, the chrysalis of the monarch butterfly. You've all seen butterflies, you've seen chrysalises. And this little green jewel would hang there, had a little gold and black band around the abdomen. And inside, it looked like green goo. But over the course of a week, that green goo would become a butterfly. And you would see the wings form. And the day before it would hatch, you would see the pigments go into the butterfly, the orange and the black. All the pigments would go in, and the green little jewel would turn into a monarch butterfly colored jewel. And then that morning, it would hatch out the bottom. It would crack out of its little chrysalis, hang upside down, and it would pump fluid into its wings, and the wings, which were all folded up, would expand out. That fluid would harden. Now it could fly away, and off it would go. I was always fascinated by the idea that this could happen. How does this happen? How does this one little egg go through all these changes and become this butterfly? And then happen again, and then happen again. These were things that interested me at the time. So we want to think about what we've learned in the last, particularly the last 45 years or so. And so there's going to be the next few days, this week and next, there'll be a little bit of biology, there'll be a little bit of medical history perhaps, there'll be a little bit of philosophy. We might even have a glancing blow from physics, which will make Mr. Pfefferly happy. This is not so that we become biologists or historians or philosophers or, heaven forbid, become physicists, but instead we want to give all of us, as intelligent Christians, an ever-growing confidence in the living and the true God, because we want to look at his creation. We want to look at everything that he has made, think about those things. We are surrounded by materialist and pagan philosophies and philosophers, and we want to understand that what is true of everything else in this fallen world is true of science also. We don't need to be afraid of science in any way. We need to acknowledge that scientists will pervert it, change it, use it for their own purposes. There is the good and there is the true, and then there are all the ways that fallen man perverts the good and the true. We have learned astonishing things about the universe looking outwardly over immense distances, and we have learned astonishing things about life, chemistry, and physics looking down and into the smallest things imaginable. So, let's start, if you will, in your Bibles, at Romans chapter 1. verses 16 to 20. And read what Paul wrote to the Romans about 2,000 years ago now. Close to. And keeping in mind, when you read the book of Romans, you are reading a letter to a mixed group of, mixed background group of people. Some of them have Jewish monotheistic backgrounds, some of them have Greek or Gentile backgrounds and heritage. I also encourage you, when you read any book of the Bible, and including Romans or any of the Old Testament books, do not read with a sense of chronological snobbery. Do not read it with the idea that, well, you know, they were primitives. They were so much more ignorant than we are. They really weren't. They technologically didn't have what we have, but technologically they were quite advanced, mentally incredibly sophisticated, and don't let Darwinian evolutionary thinking come in and convince us that we're actually reading about primitive people here and how they thought. So in Romans chapter 1, starting at verse 16, think about as we read this that Paul is going to say that there are two things. He doesn't use the word science, but there are two things that science teaches us about the nature of God. So here's Paul at verse 16. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it, the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. And here's what I want to focus on. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. So whatever our background, and whether we are Jewish monotheists, polytheistic pagans, agnostic atheists, materialist neo-Darwinists, whatever we want to call ourselves, it really doesn't matter. We are without excuse. We are without excuse whether we live in first century Rome or 21st century Tacoma, because the invisible attributes of God, his eternal power and his divine nature, are clearly perceived in the things that have been made. And this is what science tells us about the things that have been made, looking at them ever more clearly. So our excuses are getting thinner and thinner, and particularly with the scientific advances that have occurred within the lifetimes of the older members of this congregation. And so that is by way of introduction to think about what some of those advances have been and how we are seeing more clearly and how to think about that a bit. So we move on to part one today, and our goal today is to define life, and using both sides of the paper if necessary. So take out a number two pencil, as they would say at Covenant High School, a clean sheet of paper, and get ready to write an essay. We're going to try to define life and see if we can do this. And then if we have extra time at the end, we'll go downstairs to the science lab and we'll try to create life in the lab. So now we're going to, before we create life in the lab or even define life, we're going to start even further back in the Bible. Let's go to the very beginning of Genesis chapter 1 and pull out those familiar words. And for my purposes this morning, I want to just emphasize certain words, which I will try to bring out in the reading, but I want you to hear the words seed, and I want you to hear the words according to its kind, wherever they appear in this narrative in Genesis 1. And these will, I'll just tell you where we're skipping to, but we'll start at verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. Now skip down to verse 11, where we start getting mentions of life being created. So verse 11, and God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit, in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit, in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning the third day. Now skip down to verse 20. And God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning the fifth day, and God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image. There's a change. Man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them, and God blessed them. So far, Genesis chapter 1. So, now let's pause and return to the original assignment for today. How do you define life? And let me make it real simple, super easy. This is a really easy question. How do you define life? We'll make it easy. Let's make it a single cell. You all know what an amoeba is, right? Little blob cell that floats around in dirty water and moves around. It's got one cell. It's got a nucleus. It moves. It'll divide into two cells and make more amoebas or amoebae. Thinking about that little amoeba or little friend, what defines it as alive? You're now a biologist. You're going to define life because you wish to study it. What is it? Any thoughts? Contributions? There are no wrong answers. Actually, there are wrong answers, but yes, sir. Okay, so the ability to reproduce is one of the considered one of the hallmarks of life. That a cell can either divide asexually, just by cell division, as many of our cells do in our bodies, or the organism can reproduce by sexual means, recombining with another like cell and doing so in some sexual means. But anyway, the ability to reproduce is considered a hallmark of life. What else? Metabolism. Metabolism is a broad concept. So the idea is that the cell has the capacity to convert chemicals around its environment and build things out of it, build structure out of it. You have to make an amoeba out of something. And if you're going to make two amoebas or three, you have to make them out of something. They have to be able to take constituents, chemicals, other things out of its environment and build new amoebas. It also has, so that's called catabolism. And then you have to have the capacity to use some chemicals in your environment for energy, because all of this requires energy. That's actually catabolism, anabolism, converting into structure. Not important, but anyway, you have to build things, use energy is the bottom line. Okay, so very good. What else? What else constitutes alive?
A teleological aspect of the thing.
A teleological aspect, teleological?
Teleological.
So okay. So Bob is bringing up a philosophy of teleology, that it has an end point or a purpose, a reason to exist. I don't think we would use that as part of our definition for life, because we could say the same thing about a rock. right? We could say other things that are inanimate also have teleological purpose. So I'm not sure we would use that specifically for life, but it's a good... See, I told you there'd be wrong answers. Go ahead. Yes. Okay. So how do you define death?
Lack of life.
Yes.
I don't want to answer all the
questions. Yeah, I don't want to answer all the questions. Teacher's pet. Scott doesn't want to answer all the questions. Right. So we do. We define death in terms of life. So going back to the rock sits there. And you say, is the rock alive or is the rock dead? Well, that's a nonsense question, right? The rock was never alive, so it can't be dead. But if you look at the amoeba under a microscope, you can see, is the amoeba alive or is the amoeba dead? You can actually recognize. You can look at it and you can see that one's alive, that one's dead. So the question is, what is that? What is that spark? So... what else?
Ability to grow and move.
Yes. So there's something that animates cells, the ability to grow, the ability to move. That gets into how it interacts with its environment, and it also gets into what biologists call homeostasis, the ability to regulate its own internal self. It has a self. It can regulate that apart from its environment. So even the amoeba has an amoeba self. It is a thing. It regulates itself internally, and it's different from what's outside of it. So metabolism, yes. Okay, well, that's all very good. Growing, moving, responding to stimuli, adapting to changes in its environment, moving away from too hot, moving, you know, whatever it is. All of those things help define life. So now a question. If you know what a virus is, a virus is basically a package of DNA or RNA instructions, code, genetic code, surrounded in a capsule. So it looks like a little jewel. Some of them look like almost like little spaceships from Star Wars. Some of them look like spheres with little spikes on them, as you know, from coronavirus. They all have different shapes. But a virus does not have a nucleus. It does not have any of its own machinery that a cell has. And if you put a virus right there and don't do anything with it, it just sits there. It's like a rock. So the question is a virus alive or not? Yeah.
Well, they're primarily theoretical, are they not?
Viruses are?
Primarily theoretical. They have to produce a lot of theory around what they see in the microscope to create their idea. Well,
viruses are real structures. They're real things, and they are actually everywhere. Most viruses infect bacterial cells, not human cells. Only a few viruses are actually infectious to humans. Most viruses, if you look out at the Puget Sound, every spoonful of seawater is teeming with viruses. Those are easily identified. Little capsular structures with genetic material in them. So they are real things. The question for us, though, is, are they alive or not? And the answer is, go ahead. So for a virus, any virus to reproduce, it has to hijack or parasitize another cell, whether a bacterium, a human cell, an animal cell. Again, most viruses actually are interacting with bacteria. They're called bacteriophages. And they have to somehow attach to another cell, inject in their genetic material, That genetic material then hijacks the cells like a zombie, makes new viruses, and the new viruses explode out and then go off and infect other cells. So it's very similar to computer viruses. That's a very good model of what happens, which is a section of code gets in your hard drive and starts reproducing itself using your machine. Pardon me? That's exactly why they call them viruses, yeah. Yeah. So the virus is not alive. That's probably the predominant view in biology. So it's hard to kill something that's not alive. So part of the reason we've never cured the common cold, cold viruses are hard to kill when they're not actually alive. You have limited targets that you can kill on something that's not actually alive. So a virus is just inert if it's just sitting there. If it gets taken into another cell, then it reproduces its material. But there's a debate in biology. Nobody can really decide if it's alive or not. Enjoy. Yes.
So, does it have kind of a will of its own? Does it actively seek things out, or is it just hanging around and then another cell latches onto it? How dead is it?
How dead is it? Well, Princess Bride, yeah, we can work with the mostly dead, not all dead. So a virus has to have a host, like any other parasite. So the host, if the host has the right receptors on its surface, and the virus chemically and structurally, shape-wise, actually attaches to that host, and then that host, because of cellular mechanics, draws that in, and then the virus, recognizing chemically that it is now inside a cell and has all the protein enzymes to reproduce itself. It has to reproduce its DNA, or in the case of some viruses, RNA. It has to reproduce all of its capsule structure. It has to reproduce its long code and make more proteins. And then it has to assemble all those within the cell and then explode the cell and send, one virus going into a cell, exploding out a 100,000 other viruses out into the environment. And so different viruses affect different things. At the beginning of my career, the epidemic that was going on was the AIDS epidemic. So when I first started medicine in the mid-80s, AIDS was a huge deal. It was a terrifying time. It was a terrifying time because patients with AIDS died. And at that time, they all died. There are only really two viral diseases that we know of that had 100% or almost 100% mortality rate. One was AIDS, one is rabies. So almost all other viruses, Ebola virus, for instance, has about a 50% untreated fatality rate. But all other viruses have a much lower fatality rate, but they make people sick if they're infectious viruses. The AIDS virus, for instance, infected only a specific type of cell that your immune system makes, a particular cell that is involved in your immune system response to other infections. And so the AIDS virus would infect and would be received by, would go into this particular immune system cell and reproduce and destroy those cells. So your cell counts of this particular immune system type of cell, one type, would go down and down and down and down. And down to the point where you could no longer fight off all these other infections. We started seeing weird protozoan infections, weird pneumonias nobody had ever seen, weird cancers nobody ever saw. All because the AIDS virus was wiping out one particular cell, just one, mostly. And that's how people would die. So it's a complicated subject, but the point for here at the moment is the definition of what life actually is has never been settled upon. You can't get a biologist necessarily to put their nickel down and say, here's the absolute definition of what we're studying. And it's hard if you are studying something and you can't really clearly define what it is. It's also then impossible to reproduce it. And I will just tell you that there are a lot of things in life that are like that. So you're hearing a lot about artificial intelligence right now, but nobody can really tell you what intelligence is. Nobody can tell you what consciousness really is. Nobody can tell you what a memory actually consists. Nobody can tell you what awareness and thought actually is, or how it's produced, or how it becomes. Go ahead, Amy. Yes. That's exactly right. And that's important to say and important to recognize. That's why I said you can look at an amoeba, like you just said. Under a microscope, you can tell dead from alive. So,
that's not brought up in this discussion at large, in the larger popular discussion. Is it? I mean, I don't hear it.
It is what?
Just how it's so self-evident.
Oh. Well, part of what I want to accomplish, if I can, this week and next, is just to give you a sense of how society maybe talks about these things, and to have us have the tools to maybe challenge some of those assumptions that come across in our popular culture, our literature, you know, our news media, all the ways. What you'll see is that Darwinism, for instance, permeates everything. It permeates our language, our thought, how we think about politics, how we think about society, anthropology, everything else. And I think it's important to recognize why. And what I really want to get to, hopefully next week too, and I'll leave you with this, I'll give you this mental image now. Darwin, as a theory to explain life becoming more complex from simple precursors, Darwin's theory is largely of common descent from a common ancestor becoming over time much more complicated under natural selection. I don't want to leave you with the idea that Darwin got everything wrong. He didn't get everything wrong, but on his main thrust, it's not any longer possible. It's not possible. It never was possible theologically because it's an anti-God theory. But what I want you to take away from this week and next is that scientifically it's not possible either. Darwin's theory of common descent, and as an explanation for the diversity of life, is now a zombie theory. And so if you ever saw the movie Tombstone, where Johnny Ringo, the bad guy, has his shootout with Doc Holliday shoots Johnny Ringo, and Doc Holliday knows that he's killed Johnny Ringo. The audience knows that Johnny Ringo is dead. But Johnny Ringo doesn't quite know yet that he's dead. And he's still staggering about just before he collapses, and he's shooting off his gun in every direction. Darwin's theory is Johnny Ringo. Okay. Darwin's theory was killed back in the 1950s. And since then, like Johnny Ringo, he's just sort of staggering about and firing off his six guns, but you need to see why. We'll go into this a little bit. When Darwin wrote his book, the full title is On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. He wrote that book in 1859. And I started college about 120 years later. And in that 120-year period from the time that Darwin wrote his book to when I started at Purdue in 1980, there was an explosion of scientific knowledge in all disciplines, and certainly not least in biology. When I was at Purdue, I was a biology major, starting in 1980. Some of my professors wore Darwin t-shirts. They understood how species developed. They understood how life had evolved on the Earth. They understood how organic molecules had originated from inorganic molecules under the right circumstances. Organic molecules are molecules that exist in living things. Inorganic are not. It had been done in the lab, creating organic molecules. It had been done in the lab. These professors knew how molecules then naturally organized themselves into the first primordial cells. They had an explanation for the origin of life, something actually that Darwin himself did not attempt. We'll get to that. Just 27 years before I started at Purdue, James Watson and Francis Crick at Cambridge had described DNA as a double helix structure. And if you go on the Great Britain tour and they go to Cambridge, you can go to see the outside of the Cavendish lab, and then you can also see the bar. There's a marker, I think, Dick, there's a marker in the bar where Watson and Crick used to hang out and drink beers and talk about DNA. After 1953, when Watson and Crick wrote their paper, shortly after that, DNA was then understood to be the code, the software, the instruction manual for everything else, and its connection to how you make protein structures out of that code was better understood. Geneticists were using fruit flies to study mutations and how mutations descended through different generations spread through generations. And so when I was at Purdue, we used fruit flies to model our genetics. Fruit flies have nice and short life cycles, and they have lots of potential mutations. And for whatever reason, nobody really cared if we created zombie fruit flies in the lab, and we didn't worry that they might escape and eradicate all humankind on the Earth at that time. But we made zombie fruit flies, and we followed fruit fly mutations down through fruit fly children and fruit fly grandchildren. We calculated how often those mutations appeared in each generation, whether the trait was dominant or recessive or sex-linked or whatever it was. We loved fruit flies. I spent a lot of Saturday nights at the lab with fruit flies because they hatch when they hatch, and you can't really time that very well. And by the way, I can still identify the sex of any given fruit fly. And there are two. There are only two. But I also remember in those years, one professor bravely registered a small note of caution for us. He said that of all the proteins in the animal cells that we had by then only probably characterized perhaps 1% of them at the most at that point, and that there was a lot more we didn't know than what we thought we knew. He didn't think we knew all that much. But as my wife says, every party needs a pooper. And that was him. So in the years since, scientific knowledge in all these fields has exploded further. The Human Genome Project, which then took DNA from human chromosomes, of which there are 46, that project started in 1990. And it was over 92% completed by 2003. And it's been completely completed by just 2 years ago in 2023. All 46 human chromosomes have now been sequenced, coded out. There are 3.1 billion DNA base pairs on average. If you don't know about the Human Genome project. It is the Apollo moon landing of biology. It is the largest single biology project worldwide in history. That knowledge of cell biology and of genetics and the human genome and its applications is altering, has altered, and continues to alterate the world of medicine, our lives in all sorts of ways. There are people in our congregation who are alive today because of this research and some of these treatments. Nearly every month, if you watch TV, you're told to ask your doctor about some new drug with a name that you can't pronounce. But there are new treatments for various cancers, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease. Various and sundry plagues on humankind are now marketed and available. Some of those treatments actually do work. And some of them work astonishingly well. Not all of them do. And so the result of this and a lot of other research over the past 40 years has been that the scientific understanding of life, what composes it, how it arose, has only moved further away from our understanding. The last 40 years have rendered Darwin's explanation of speciation and descent from common ancestry not only improbable, but mathematically, chemically, and biologically impossible. Much of the problem that Darwin now suffers has to do with the nature of information and of information theory. DNA, which is the code, is transcribed to RNA, and RNA is then translated into proteins. And proteins are chemical structures that have actual shapes. And proteins convey information themselves. And they convey information based upon their shape, the way they are folded, the way chemically they are put together, how they are assembled. They also convey information in the ways that they assemble with other proteins to make ever larger structures. And that conveys information in life. If you want something else to worry about, have you heard of prion diseases? You have. You may not know them by that term. You've heard of mad cow disease. Okay. Prion diseases, like mad cow disease or chronic wasting disease in deer, or in humans, it's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Prion diseases are misshapen proteins, not genetic material, not cells, not even viruses, just a protein that somehow or other gets into brains, and that misshapen protein stimulates other proteins to then shape themselves similarly and starts doing damage in the neurological system. And it's really hard to kill something that is really definitely not alive, but is just a protein that has to be addressed. And it's hard to address a protein because once you try to denature or structurally change a protein, it's very hard not to change all the other proteins around it and destroy everything in its path. Usually by direct contact and ingestion, and nobody knows kind of stuff. It's a scary kind of stuff. That's why everybody gets excited about mad cow disease and chronic wasting disease in deer, because we don't really know how to keep it from infecting other animals and other people. So in our few minutes remaining, I want to give you just let me give you a really quick overview of how we got to, and this is a very superficial overview of how we got to a materialistic, a naturalistic, a Darwinian explanation for life and the origins of life, and why this is so pervasive in our culture, why so many non-believers grabbed on to this, okay? If you want a really good summary, I highly commend this book to you. This is Stephen Meyer's Signature in the Cell. He summarizes this very, very well and at considerable length. Key dates Just a few key dates, but first one is 200 years ago, roughly 1828, 197 years ago. There was a German scientist named Friedrich Wöhler who made urea in the lab. Urea is an organic compound. Urea is found in urine. We still measure blood urea nitrogen in your blood. Urea is found in urine, but Wöhler made it from inorganic chemical precursors and thereby crossed the line being able to synthesize an organic compound from inorganic precursors. This had not ever been done before. He was quite excited about it. He bragged to a chemist friend, quote, this is German chemical humor, okay, so pay attention. There's nothing better than German chemical humor. Wöhler writes to a chemist friend, quote, I can no longer hold back my chemical water and I have to let out that I can make urea without needing a kidney. Ha, ha, ha. No reaction. You got to be a German chemist to get that one.
It's a Mino world without.
And now we're done. Prior to Wöhler's experiment, most biologists were vitalists. They believed that living organisms had a distinctly different sort of existence from non-living matter, a little bit like Amy was talking about before. We can tell life from non-life, and so you were a vitalist. That made sense. Wöhler's experiment, however, opened the door to a chemical explanation for the origin of life and really unleashed the materialists, who were then able to postulate that perhaps life forms from inorganic compounds and lots of time. Stephen Meyer will constantly comment on his podcasts and in his books, time is always the hero of these stories. Okay, time is the hero of these stories, lots of time. In the 1850s, now we're going to bring in the German physicists, this will make Mike happy. The 1850s, 170 years ago, a German physicist named Hermann von Helmholtz demonstrated that conservation of energy applied whether a system was a living system or not a living system. Since energy is neither created nor destroyed, and since that's true in living cells and non-living matter, by the 1860s and by the 1870s, it was possible to demonstrate by chemical analysis that this was actually the case, so that living cells followed the laws of thermodynamics. And so we don't have to worry about vital forces, and we don't have to worry about then that life is anything particularly special. It's merely chemistry and physics like everything else. Then we move on to a statement from Rudolf Virchow. Virchow, another German, if you see a pattern here. Virchow wrote, everywhere there is mechanistic process only, with unbreakable necessity of cause and effect. Virchow was a German physician, he was a pathologist, he was a biologist, he was also a politician. If you want to know where all the arguments about socialized medicine come from, you can go back, you can do worse than to go back and start with Virchow in the late 1800s. That's an aside. In the latter 1800s, every American doctor worth his salt traveled to Europe to study with the greats. Virchow was always on the itinerary. Oddly enough, Virchow, who followed Darwin, thought that Darwin was an ignoramus. That was the word he used. He's an ignoramus. And he was anti-Darwin, although he was not anti-Darwin for religious reasons, but for scientific reasons. By the time Darwin wrote his book on the origin of species, and we'll have to end here, cells were recognized, but cells were understood as packets of homogeneous protoplasm. It was just protoplasm. The problem of the origin of life was likely to have a simple solution because simple organisms, one-celled organisms, were in fact simple. In general, you don't have to worry in the 1860s about explaining detailed biological structures if you don't know anything about detailed biological structures, DNA, proteins, and so on. So to them at that time, to Darwin, single-celled organisms looked like the equivalent of a paper airplane. It did not look like the equivalent of a 737. Now it looks like a 737 or worse, or more. So in the 1860s, we have the protoplasmic theory of life. The attributes of all living things resided in their protoplasm inside the walls of these cells, which were just bags of protoplasm. Thomas Henry Huxley, who was such a fan of Darwin's theory that he was known as Darwin's bulldog, is quoted as saying that protoplasm constituted the physical basis or matter of life. Protoplasm was the basis of all life. This theory was then dominant until the 1890s and the early 1900s, when proteins, enzymes, fats, lipids, other complex structures were actually identified. And so protoplasmic theory then became a zombie theory, and it died. Again, like Johnny Ringo, shot by complicated structures and didn't stand up to that bullet. And it took a while to die out because it's hard for things to die out. So we're going to have to stop there at this point where complexity now is becoming a problem for Darwin. And Lord willing, take up next week with not the Germans, but we'll bring in the Russians. And we'll bring in Marxist ideology, because that's necessary then to explain life, believe it or not. Marx and Darwin were correspondents and others. The Russians love this theory too, and we'll go from there, and then hopefully get to a little bit briefly about the rest of the way that Darwin's now mathematically impossible, and so on. So we're out of time, but any other questions, comments, rebuttals? I don't want to confuse you too much with science, because I know there's all sorts of levels of understanding of in this room of intelligent people. I don't want to over or under explain things and confuse anybody thereby. Okay. All right. Thank you.